morning. With a day to go before the last presidential debate, could the race get any stranger? Ken Rudin gives us his preview and an assessment of the revelations from the past few days. Meanwhile, in Hawaii, a new film puts the spotlight on some of the real people we call the homeless. Filmmaker Anthony Alto joins us. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Hawaii Theater for Youth's new production, Can You Hear My Hands?, takes us into the world of the hearing impaired. We'll talk with HTY artistic director, Eric Johnson.
That's the conversation for this October 18th, otherwise known as Day 7 of the Fall Pledge Drive. We'll be back right after this news.
Good morning to you on this Day 7 of our Fall Pledge Drive. Ray Cruz with you here back at Pledge Central. And as you're working in to earn your daily bread, let's get you up to speed on what's going on. We passed the halfway mark of the drive yesterday. We're starting to see a glimmer of a light at the end of the tunnel, but we need to average $100,000 per day in order to do this. Joining me at the mics this morning before we go off to the conversation is Jose Fajardo. He's the General Manager and President of Hawaii Public Radio. Good morning, Jose.
Aloha and good morning. This is day number 7, and we're now in the stretch run to get to the final line of success for this fund drive. And we've been raising a lot of money in support of Hawaii Public Radio, and now we're asking you, the listener, to call now as well at 941-3689, 941-3689. We're asking you to do your fair share in support of public radio here in Hawaii, and that can be $5 a month, $10 a month, or $12.50 a month in support of Hawaii Public Radio.
Absolutely. In the last hour, by the way, we raised $2,250. That's a lot of money early in the morning. So thanks to our volunteers who are answering the phone this morning, really taking care of business. We're going off to the conversation. Our phone lines will be open. So if you hear something during the program or you finally got to your office and you have a little bit of spare time, give us a quick call. Say, I want to do my part to help you get to the end of the drive. 941-3689. Also, if you just want to do it on a private, you don't want to talk to anybody, just go online at hawaiipublicradio.org. When we come back, we'll be talking story with our guest and hopefully tell you what's happening here that you called 941-3689.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich, and over there, to my right, as usual, Chris
Vandercook. Good morning, Beth
Ann. Good morning.
You know, I suspect that the way most of us interact with the homeless population is to walk by as quickly as possible.
A lot of people do. A lot of people also feel a sense of distrust, anger, fear,
sure.
All kinds of emotions that a film that we're going to talk about now is looking to dispel by showing a lot of the humanity behind those people that we just sort of name as the homeless. So let's talk about that. Now, across the islands, you know that in just about every neighborhood, there are people who are homeless. And for years now, these no longer invisible people have migrated from place to place to find a spot they can at least temporarily call home. That is, until they're routed by police or convinced by outreach workers to go to a shelter. Affordable housing figures prominently in the scenarios of current and future homelessness, and that's not news to many of the people whose stories are profiled in a film soon to debut on the small screen. Anthony Alto is the filmmaker of No Room in Paradise. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Trying to see behind this term, the homeless, which by its very nature depersonalizes it and just puts over this, you know, veneer of its own little silo, somebody who is other, someone who is over there, a group. But in the way you've deconstructed that to show the people in this film, clearly you're trying to get people to understand that these are people that we're talking about, not just something that is nameless or faceless or papered over with the term the homeless. How did you decide to approach it from that perspective?
You know, that wasn't the way we were supposed to be approaching it. Rick Blangiardi, the general manager of Hawaii News Now, came to us and asked us to make a documentary. And the reason he did that, I think, is because he understood that doing these two-hour news clips on the news every evening was not winning the hearts and minds of the community at large. It was waking people up to the fact that there was a problem there, but not making them very sympathetic to it. And Rick is outraged. He thinks it's a scandal. He wants the problem taken care of. And so he actually asked us to do a kind of a 60 minutes expose that lit the fire under the politicians. And so that was the approach we had going in. And we quickly found, in fact, that amongst our elected leadership, there isn't a lack of understanding. There isn't a lack of sympathy. They want to do something. There's something else missing. And I think what we felt was that it was the support of the community at large. When we started working with the homeless, we found that we had our own biases. I think everybody has them. They're unconscious. I think it's because when we see the homeless on the streets, we see their tents, we see their shanties, we see the garbage strewn around, and we think of that as garbage. And I think unconsciously we think of the people inside those tents as human garbage. And we knew nothing about the homeless. We went to Connie Mitchell at IHS and we said, Connie, we need an education. Can you help us? And she said, by all means, why don't you follow one of our top outreach workers around? And we did that for 3 months, basically, before we turned on a camera. And we found that the people that we were meeting weren't human garbage. Surprise, surprise. In fact, if anything, they were above averagely intelligent. They were all almost uniformly articulate. They could explain how they ended up in that situation, why they were there, and they were quite capable of explaining that they didn't want to be homeless. They had aspirations. And so we found some of our biases being shed as we went along.
As you looked at the various parts, the component parts of the people who are homeless, it's not just people who you just described. I mean, very clearly in the film, you see people who are living someplace else because they are truly hearing and seeing things that the rest of us are not. Or you have homeless veterans who look and say, I never expected to be here, and feel that their country has let them down, their community has let them down. You look at various different sectors of the people that we refer to as the homeless and try to deconstruct what we feel about them based on some of those implicit biases, and then to take us to a different place. But all those stories seem to go back to that very serious grounding of we need to break ground on more affordable housing units. And the clear math that you try to show in this film is, look, we're spending the money anyway. There's a smarter way of spending it. Do people begin to understand that enough? Is that simple enough for people to understand that we are, in fact, spending this money anyway?
I don't think so, and that is one of the goals of the film. And as I said, the politicians understand it. They want to do something about it. So that's clearly not the issue. The issue is that to take care of the problem, you mentioned affordable housing. The legislature set the goal in the last session of building 22,000 affordable rentals in the next 10 years. Each affordable rental requires about $100,000 in subsidy. So we're talking about $2.2 billion. If you were to issue general obligation bonds for those 22,000 units at today's interest rates, triple tax-free, it would cost about $100 million a year to amortize. How much did the legislature appropriate to build affordable housing in the last session? $100 million. We're already spending the money. The same goes with the problems of the people on the streets, the people who have mental issues, the people who have addictions. They are costing us a fortune. So we thought, let's go and show how much money we're spending so that when the politicians get the courage up to say we need to borrow $2.2 billion to build this affordable housing, or we need to spend another $35 million on case management, on services for the mentally ill, on drug addiction, the community at large won't go and say, what the heck, how can you do that? They will say, oh yeah, we get it. We're already spending that money. Yes, we will support that if it's finally going to put a stop to the problem.
Is there someone that you see from all the people that you've talked to, many of the people we've talked to, and the list is long, who actually has that kind of backbone to be able to make that case successfully and to push it through?
Oh, my God, Bethann, this is why they pay you the big bucks. You ask a very difficult question there. I don't know. I'd like to believe that our political leadership, that our governor and our mayor do. At the moment, we see them taking the steps. They are doing things. There is progress happening behind the scenes. They are breaking down the silos. They're starting to work together. I was at a ceremony yesterday where the governor and the mayor got together with Duane Carisu to start to so that the state gave the land to the city. The city signed a lease with Duane Carisu, who's a successful businessman. They're going to build a sort of a plantation village. Rents for people there are going to be $400 to $500. It's going to be for 200 homeless families. That will make a significant dent in the problem. So they are doing things. If you go and talk to people in the Department of Health, the Department of Human Services, they're breaking down the silos. They're working together. Is there anybody in the legislature or in the governor's office who's prepared to come out and say we're going to borrow $2.2 billion to build affordable housing? I don't know if we're there yet. I really don't.
Well, perhaps this film will help us understand it a little bit better and get there. Anthony, I wish we had more time to talk. Maybe we'll have to do that soon.
Anytime you like. Thanks so much, Bethann.
All the best. Anthony Alto is a Honolulu-based documentary filmmaker, former war correspondent, and chair of the Sierra Club of Oahu. No Room in Paradise is his latest film spotlighting Hawaii's homeless crisis. It'll premiere tomorrow night on KGMB.
Support for today's programming comes from the Maui Chamber Orchestra. The new season opens with music of Handel, Telemann, Bach, and Schubert this Saturday and Sunday at the Iao Theater. Tickets at mauichamberorchestra.org.
Good morning, everyone. Ray Cruz with you here at Pledge Central at Hawaii Public Radio on our semi-annual pledge drive. Let's get you up to speed on what's going on. We are beyond the halfway point of our drive here. We'd like to finish on time, if not earlier. The only way we're going to be able to do that is by averaging $100,000 a day or more to bring this drive to a successful conclusion. And be like Greg Ewan, who called and made an additional gift not too long ago and said, "You're always there when I turn on the radio every morning. You always depend on Hawaii Public Radio to be there. And the only way we can be there is by you being here with us on a daily basis, calling us until this drive comes to an end." The number to call is 941-3689, 941-3689, or you can pledge online at hawaiipublicradio.org. We have $700 to go on that matching gift that's on the table, Jose Fajardo.
Absolutely. We have a challenge from a friend from Kahala who is challenging our listeners right now to take that next step in their listening habit. That's to get in the habit of supporting public radio. They're going to double your contribution up to a $1,000 gift. And right now we have $700 remaining on that challenge. Go to the phone now. We know you're listening to the conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We know that you value Hawaii Public Radio, and know that we value your listenership and your membership at 941-3689. We have a lot of money to raise, but we have great momentum going our way as well. We want you to be a part of this excitement of raising money for Hawaii Public Radio at 941-3689.
You know, every morning you tune into the conversation to nourish your knowledge about what's going on around the state. We want you to nourish your bodies, and we have a couple of tickets left, actually three. If you weren't tuning in last week, Chef Mavro was here with his annual Christmas in Provence. If you'd like to make a pledge of $37.50 per month, you can call 941-3689, 941-3689. It's a great way to help us get that much closer to the end of this drive and enjoy some great food by Chef Marvo. That's Christmas in Provence, 941-3689. Joining us this morning is Toby Portner and Melissa White. They're both from the High Fashion Incubator. Good morning, ladies. How are you?
Morning. Fantastic.
Great, great. One of the things that I'm really excited about when we were talking story before we went on the air is that you are both members, sustaining members of Hawaii Public Radio, and you started a long time ago back on the mainland.
That's right. And I don't even remember when it started. Hawaii Public Radio has always just been around in the background. It's how I learned about the world, and questions came up, and I raised my child on it, and it's just a natural part of what we do.
We hear that all the time here at Hawaii Public Radio. How about yourself, Melissa? Same thing?
I came onto it in college. I was living in Oregon, and I was listening to the local public radio station.
I was turned on to all sorts of things through that. And when I moved here, I just had to take the plunge and join up. And what you said earlier really struck me about how these sustaining memberships, these monthly small donations, really help cut down the length of the pledge drive. So everyone out there, you're welcome. And you can be like us if you call 941-3689.
So. And I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. 941-3689. We still have that challenge grant on the table. So important that we make these challenge grants because they activate another $1,000 to our grand total, which gets us a step closer to our overall goal to be successful for this fund drive. $700 on the table right now. Call double your contribution amount by calling 941-3689.
Melissa?
We have a new member to thank, a first time sustaining member from Maui, Paul Fisk. He loves the variety of broadcasts on HPR, especially Performance Today. Mahalo, Paul.
Yeah, and Jake Shimabukuro was a guest. If you missed it, well, what can I tell you? 941-3689. You know, we have a matching gift on the table besides that other one that Jose just told you about. We have a matching gift on the table from MKC Hawaii, and they're putting up $1,200 for every call a new member that comes in from Maui today. So if you pledge, you call 1-877-941-3689 from Maui, and you pledge, let's say for the sake of discussion, $10 or even $12.50 a month, you'll get a t-shirt. But not only that, your pledge now becomes double. So if you call at $10 a month, it's a $20 a month pledge. If you $12.50, you do the math. It's 25 and so on and so forth. So give us a call, especially from the neighbor islands, 1-877-941-3689, or here on Oahu at 941-3689. Our volunteers are standing by waiting to hear from you.
You know, Toby and Melissa, where you start listening to public radio in Michigan and Oregon, they had one transmitter to broadcast the city wherever you were living. And one of the reasons that it costs so much in Hawaii to operate Hawaii Public Radio, it's not just the cost of living, is we have 14 transmitters scattered around the islands of Hawaii so that we can take the programming of HPR 1 and HPR 2 to all the citizens of Hawaii. And that's an extra cost that we have to cover here at Hawaii Public Radio. And that's why we come to you during these days to ask you to give at 941-3689. So important for you to give right now.
So we're going back to the conversation. Again, our phone lines will be open during the program, 941-3689. There's so many things on the table, and the only thing that's missing from this whole equation is you. We need to hear from you right now. Give us a call. We'll be back and talk more story with Jose, Melissa, and Toby here at Hawaii Public Radio.
Thanks, Ray and Jose at the Pledge Table, and you're back with the conversation on HPR2. Honolulu Theater for Youth's new production is called Can You Hear My Hands?, and it opens a window into a world where sound and image meet, the world of the deaf and hearing impaired. It's a production designed to be accessible to all audiences, and Eric's with us this morning in our studio, Eric Johnson, Artistic Director of HTY. And you know, Eric, the thing that you always hear about people who have one sense limited in some way is that the other senses are heightened.
Absolutely, and I think that is clearly the case. And I think with the deaf culture, it is especially acute in that, we're a community here in Honolulu who loves to experience different cultures around
right.
us. And, you know, so even if we're not Chinese, we'll enjoy Chinese New Year.
Sure.
And vice versa. But in entering the deaf culture, what you're getting is their own culture and community mm-hmm. in that they have their own language, which is sign language. They have their own performance traditions. They have a way of looking at art. And again, like you were hitting on, it's a visual way of looking at art.
Yeah.
And so whereas sonic information is less important, you know, the visual and language and poetry and rhyming and, you know, all of those are become these really interesting riffs on art in general.
You also got me thinking, Eric, about the visual component of a conversation. You know, the things we do here on the radio show go out in one dimension, the dimension mm-hmm. of sound. But as we're sitting here in the studio, there's a great deal of visual cueing that goes on back and forth that we completely take for granted in most of our day-to-day interactions.
Absolutely. And I think, deaf culture actually created the football huddle, the first people to huddle up so that the other team wouldn't, copy their signs. Baseball that was picked up. That's sign language right there.
Yeah.
So I think there are, tons of ways that we communicate visually with each other. And for this project, the way I sort of backed into this is I became really interested with a local performer, Ed Chevy, who was doing a series of Edgar Allan Poe stories. And he was just this amazing performer, one of the best actors I'd ever seen anywhere in the world. And as I learned more about Ed, I found out that he actually is a bass player in the world's only deaf rock band. They're entirely deaf musicians. It's called Beethoven's Nightmare.
Uh-huh.
And Ed has traveled the world performing for these deaf audiences, mainly percussion and bass. And he is completely deaf. With his hearing aid, he does hear vibrations. And they have trained themselves to make this music. And the lovely thing about music is it is vibration.
Sure.
And can be represented visually as well. So that's how he experiences music. And as we started working on the show, what started out was like, we're going to do some Poe stories for Halloween. I realized, let's get into the deaf culture. Let's get into some of the stories of his life. His mom was one of the first deaf dancers who danced flamenco with Bob Hope and actually traveled all around the world. She met Helen Keller as a young lady and danced with Helen Keller the first time Helen Keller had ever danced. And we, so we took some of these stories from Ed's life, and then we took some performances from that come right out of deaf culture, because there are whole performance traditions that are sort of based on sign language and visual theater that are a piece of deaf culture. And so we're doing some of those. We're, of course, telling a Poe story, because that's, one of Ed's things.
Sure.
And then he also, in the show, is rocking out on the bass and kind of explains hearing and the ear and how that works. So we're hoping that the show is really an introduction to deaf culture, an introduction to Ed and his life and his experience as a deaf person, and a new look into music and theater in a completely different way. And it's completely accessible to both deaf audiences and hearing audiences.
And Eric, as you use the term deaf culture, you get me thinking about how a culture is created. And one of the ways in which you can create a culture, frequently a culture is created by a beleaguered culture that is suppressed in some way. And it's almost as if you can create a culture by marginalizing a community and then sort of putting pressure on it, press down and you'll get that response. No, I can do it. Don't tell me I can't.
Right. That has certainly, beautiful, beautiful things have blossomed out of the deaf community. And just spending 10 minutes from Ed, in the audience or with him directly, you realize that this is a man, this is not a handicapped person in any way. This is a person who has extraordinary abilities and is able to, both of his parents were deaf. They have creatively adapted to the world and have looked at that as, when you start framing that as a culture and not as a disadvantage. There's a famous quote, the deaf people can do anything a hearing person can do except hear. And when you look at that as, this tiny limitation and then what they're able to achieve, and certainly, what Ed, as an artist, has this articulate, passionate voice. It's really extraordinary. And I think that is the story we want to put out there. And so it's been such a gift to have him and Michelle Morris, who has been interpreting all over town at theaters, making theater and performance and those things accessible for deaf audiences, is now on stage performing, working with Ed, telling their story. And so this is a window into that culture. And And like with any culture, you're getting such a beautiful introduction into new people that you might not get to meet otherwise.
It's a real opportunity, Eric. It really sounds great. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Chris.
You bet. Eric Johnson is the artistic director of Honolulu Theater for Youth, whose production of Can You Hear My Hands runs Saturdays through November 12th at the Cathedral of St. Andrew's Tenney Theater in downtown Honolulu. There's an onstage workshop for youth this Saturday at 2:30 p.m., and you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Umurokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhamai.
In today's backyard quiz, we're going sledding Hawaiian style. In ancient Hawaii, it was a tradition to go surfing the mountain slopes and lava fields. The sport is known as he'eholua and was especially popular during the makahiki season. A papaholua, or Hawaiian sled, was constructed of wood lashed together with coconut fiber, and they were capable of reaching speeds of up to 50 miles per hour. Hawaiians would dig trenches in mountain slopes or lava fields, made smooth and covered with grass. But the sport was quickly abolished by the missionaries, who believed it to be frivolous. The last documented racing event was held in 1825. Now, the ancient art was nearly lost until a Hawaiian surfer and waterman studied the craft and built the first authentic sled in more than a century. Now, do you know who's credited with single-handedly revitalizing this traditional sport? We'll tell you in the second half of the show.
On this Tuesday morning here at Pledge Central, HPR2, good morning, everyone. Ray Cruz with you here, and you've been listening to the conversation. And, of course, you just heard Deutsche Welle News, heard right here only on The Conversation every day, Monday through Friday, one of our flagship shows in the morning. The program that ties all of the states together, of the islands together, and gives you all the information you need to know what's going on here in the 808. Get you up to speed on what's happening. First of all, we had a $1,000 matching gift on the table. We have $580 to go on that matching gift. And this morning when we opened the mics at 6 o'clock in the morning, we told you that we had to average $100,000 per day to get this drive over with on time, if not earlier. We've done it in the past. We know we can do it again. At 25 minutes till 9 o'clock, we've raised 10% of where we need to be by the end of business day when we stop pitching here at Hawaii Public Radio. And just a quick programming note, we will be carrying both stations will be carrying the debates tomorrow, and that cuts into our pitching time. So there's a lot of heavy lifting to do, and you can help us by calling us at 941-3689, 941-3689. We have something special, and there's only 2 seats left. So if you're looking for that special gift for that special someone for the holidays, this is going on, what was the date again, Gene? I have it around here somewhere. December 8th, I believe it was. So if you're looking for that special gift, it will be happening at 6:30 at Marvro's. And, of course, Chef Marvro was here last week. We have a pair of tickets that are on the table for $37.50 per month. If you're interested in picking up those last two pairs, there are no more. We are pitching it upstairs and downstairs, so don't hesitate. We need to hear from you at 941-3689 right now if you want to pick up that pair of tickets to Christmas in Provence at Chef Marlboro's restaurant on Thursday, December the 8th. Starts at 6:30. Don't wait. Don't hesitate. Give us a call, 941-3689. Jose Fajardo is joining me this morning. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. You could also go and give online safely and securely at hawaiipublicradio.org. We do have the challenge grant on the table where we will double your contribution when you give a call now at 941-3689. It's a $1,000 contribution, a matching grant, and we have $580 left. Let's get that $580 right now. We know you're listening to the conversation. It's a very important program. Takes up a lot of resources here at Hawaii Public Radio for us to invest in local programming. And if you value the local programming that this station brings to you each and every day, make it possible. We're talking to you, the listener who's listening right now, 941-3689. We have lots of wonderful thank you gifts. We have the dinner with Chef Marvro, the dinner at Christmas at Provence. We have the T-shirt at $12.50 a month. Call now, 941-3689.
But wait, there's more, Jose. We have a matching gift on the table from MKC Hawaii, and they are matching dollar for dollar new members who call in either from the neighbor islands at 1-877-941-3689 or here on Oahu. So that means that your pledge of $10 magically becomes $20 and helps us chip in to that $100,000 that we have to raise today. And just like this person did, we are joined at the table by Toby Portner of High Fashion Incubator, and she's got some people to thank.
That's right. Nicole knew what to do. She called 941-3689 and became a sustaining member for the first time. Nicole Kime Sortuna from Haleiwa. She loves listening for the news, the music, learning about the world, and her children love it too. So be like Nicole and call 941-3689 and double your investment.
And this is for Maui and Oahu only, okay? So if you're listening to us on Maui on your way into work, 1-877-941-3689.
And if you're listening on the other islands, you can still pledge, and you will have your contribution doubled by this challenge that's on the table of $1,000. $580 left to go on that at 941-3689. We have gone past the running as a marathon for the last 6.5 days. Now we're on day 7. It starts to become a sprint to the finish line as we have today, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and we want to finish this drive successfully with your help at 941-3689.
Toby Portner and Melissa White, both from High Fashion Incubator, and both of you have been guests on The Conversation. You are one of over 2,000 guests that this program has had over the past 4.5 years or so, almost 5 years they've been on the air. As Jose was just saying, that this is a program that takes up a lot of resources, a lot of work, a lot of digging around to find really interesting stories that we bring you on a daily basis, Monday through Friday. Why is a program, think about this for a second, why is a program like The Conversation important to this state and to the community at large?
Beth Ann has a way of teasing out the topics of the day that are on everybody's mind, and she's also really tapped into what's happening around town. So she pulls us in around November for Hawaii Fashion Month to talk about what's happening all over the state, people from all over the state putting on events. But she also isn't afraid to tackle those really controversial issues, and I often hear her doing so. I listen almost every morning, and it's a fantastic show. If you haven't heard it, tune in pretty much every weekday morning. And you can support the show by calling 941-3689 and becoming a sustaining member, as both Toby and I, and actually Hi-Fi, our organization, is itself a sustaining member. So we're doubling and tripling up here because we love it so much.
There you go. And that's what it's all about. If you're a person who's been on that show and you've had a chance to tell your story, listen to our story and help us continue to be on the air every Monday through Friday here with The Conversation. We're going back to the program right now. The phone lines will be open at 941-3689.
And thanks very much, Ray. Now, 10 months ago, the term of Honolulu Police Commission Chair Ron Takeda expired. Now, Mayor Caldwell has appointed Hawaii Supreme Court Associate Justice Stephen Levinson. With a reality check of political timing, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us right now. Good morning.
Politics. Oh, Beth Ann, you're so devious. Good morning to you.
Oh, you know my secret. Okay, but the real question is, why now? Okay, this has nothing to do with Steve Levinson as such, but the real issue of timing. Why not 5 months ago? Why not 3 months ago? Why now?
Right. And so Ron Takeda, head of the Carpenters Union and very influential, has turned a blind eye essentially to the Louis K. Aloha investigation to police misconduct. And the police commission has come under criticism, as has Kirk Caldwell, for maybe not really exercising enough oversight. Well, you're right. Politics is certainly part of this. Charles DeJoux, of course, challenging the mayor in the reelection campaign. And he has said that Ke Aloha should step aside while he's under investigation. Well, this was a surprise move. Did not see this one coming by appointing Steve Levinson, a very well-respected jurist, of course, a former associate justice of our own Supreme Court. That would seem to, at least from Caldwell's point of view, perhaps take one of his challenger's attacks away from him.
But we still come back to that same issue of timing, you know, and the fact that this has had to go on and on and on. Did the mayor tell you anything about why now?
No, there was nothing that we got directly from the mayor's office other than complimenting Takeda on his performance and welcoming Justice Levinson to the commission. I think the mayor will be making a more formal statement. I believe the formal appointment is coming today. Even if Justice Levinson is approved by the city council, the earliest he would take a seat on the police commission would be December. And he wouldn't necessarily become the chair either. That's a decision that's up to the seven members that are on the commission to replace Ron Takeda. So hopefully the mayor will be sharing some more information going forward as the appointment goes before the council.
You make the point that should Levinson be confirmed in all this and everything goes forward, that he would be on in December. But that would be after the election, after all the questions about the charter amendments, including question one.
Right. In fact, that charter amendment is to give the commission more authority in its duties, more oversight of the police, Honolulu Police Department. And that's something that actually Justice Levinson supports. He'd like to see that amendment passed if voters vote aye on number one. But the other thing that's kind of brewing here is when Chief Ke Aloha's case will be settled. There's some talk that it might be next month. We'll have to see. But yes, by then, possibly the election will be over. We'll see whether we still have a chief of police at that time, too.
All right. Well, lots of things for us to be watching and waiting and talking about, and we will, starting tomorrow again. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Talk to you in the morning. Chad Bloor joins us every day with a reality check.
Earlier in the show, we asked if you knew who revitalized the ancient sport of he'eholua. This makahiki-related sport is much like the one-man luge. Hawaiians would dig lanes in mountain slopes and lava fields and race one another. The best he'eholua practitioners could ride their papaholua, or sled, for more than a mile. In 1825, missionaries put a stop to the sport, considering it frivolous, and the art was almost lost until a Big Island native revitalized the sport in 1993. This daredevil once rode his lava sleds at speeds pushing 70 miles an hour, although that particular incident didn't end so well for him. The mountain left him with an 18-inch gash in his left thigh. The accident didn't stop Tom Pohaku Stone, though. He continues to be a he'eholua advocate and hits the lava slopes whenever he can.
And we had a winner, somebody we both know, Mike May, called in. And he says he has so many of the T-shirts that he's just donating this one back. So thank you very much. And thank you very much for calling, too, with the right answer. Now, if you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Other political campaigns may have been odd. Nothing has prepared us for the bizarre campaign charges and countercharges fired off during this presidential race. The last debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump happens tomorrow. We'll carry it live on both HPR 1 and HPR 2. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, has joined us over the past month while Neil Conan has been away. Ken is also traveling this morning, so we talked earlier, and I asked him if there is anything to suggest we might get a little more substance in this last debate.
No, it's been a surreal week, and to predict what's going to happen in the debate, well, could you have predicted what was said in last week's debate with the Hillary, you should be in prison, and you have hate in your heart, and I have all the women who Bill Clinton was with, I have them in the debate hall. I mean, now Donald Trump says, I'm going to be unshackled. Now, if he was shackled in the last debate, my goodness, I can't imagine what tomorrow's debate is going to look like.
Unfortunately, one of the things that's been happening with all this high melodrama is not a lot of real substantive talk. There have been some people who have been upset that we're not talking more about Hillary and the emails and WikiLeaks promising to release more. Is that more high drama, or are there issues there that you think that really should be delved into?
Are you saying that whether we should be talking about the WikiLeaks? Because if that's what your question is, I think the answer is yes. I think one of the reasons both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have such high unfavorable numbers is that there's a trust issue with Hillary Clinton. It just shows in every poll. And while, again, I'm not doing any false equivalency, I'm not comparing Hillary Clinton with Donald Trump in this instance, but we learned in many of the WikiLeaks leaks that she does say one thing to one audience and another. She did say good things to Goldman Sachs and Wall Street that she didn't say on the campaign trail. She is calculating, and I think that's what drove the Bernie Sanders people so nuts, not all of whom have come on board because they don't trust her. But having said that, I mean, I think there's really no comparison to what Donald Trump has done, at least regarding civility. And, you know, the moderator in tomorrow's debate is Chris Wallace, and he, like the previous moderators, have said, look, we have some subjects I want to talk about. I want to talk about immigration and the debt and the Supreme Court and foreign policy. But ultimately, there's a candidate that when you ask him one question, he'll go on to something else immediately, and it's hard to steer him back to what you wanted him to talk about to begin with.
Which means to say that we may be viewing another political hijacking.
Look, I think I'm seeing a scorched earth policy, not only taking down Hillary Clinton and not only taking down the Republican Party, which could happen and lower ballot House and Senate races, but he's also questioning the legitimacy of the election. And when you have people questioning whether democracy really works and whether it's fair, you're doing much more damage than just saying that Hillary Clinton belongs in jail or Paul Ryan should be, you know, they should get rid of him as Speaker of the House. It's more than attacking candidates. It's, if you put down in the system, there are people who will never accept what the results are. And if you think that the country was split after Bush v. Gore in 2000 with the Supreme Court decision, I suspect it would be much worse this time if that's what happened.
And this is, you know, far more than just Donald Trump trying to pave the way for a potential loss with some of this conversation about voter fraud and about rigged elections. All of that just seems to be thwarting the entire political process, not necessarily being able to put out a message about what may happen in a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, I wanted to ask you about Hillary Clinton going out to campaign in states where traditionally Democrats haven't done very well. I mean, I'm thinking about Arizona and Indiana, Missouri. Is she really able to expand her base?
Well, that's a very, very good question. She probably has a better ability to do that than Donald Trump does. I don't think he's winning over any undecided. But having said that, I think there's more than that when Hillary Clinton is doing. Even if she doesn't win Arizona, which I don't think she does, she's not going to win Missouri, she's not going to win Indiana. But there are key down-ballot races there. John McCain is in a tough Senate race in Arizona. Rory Blunt, the Republican senator, is in a tough battle, a surprisingly tough battle in Missouri. Richard Burr is in a tough battle in North Carolina. And there's a very there's a close Senate race in Indiana with Evan Bayh, the Democrat, trying to make a comeback. So even if she doesn't win those states, she may, you know, excite the base enough that it could push some of these Democratic Senate candidates, gubernatorial candidates, House candidates over the top.
At this point, when we have only a few more weeks of all of this to go, and clearly we don't know what's going to happen when we hit the debate on Wednesday night, Is there anything that you can see that we really haven't talked about enough that you think people should focus on instead of a lot of this high drama?
Oh, my goodness, of course. I mean, there's so much to talk about. I mean, the problem is that there are many people on the left who don't feel that Hillary Clinton has a sufficient progressive ideology. There are many Republicans who don't feel that Donald Trump has an ideology at all. It's all opportunism and making headlines. But there are so many questions about what you would do. I mean, it's one thing to say that I'll stop ISIS, I'll bomb the heck out of ISIS, but how do you stop that? What do you do? Do you have a no-fly policy in Syria? If you do that, do you shoot down Russian planes? There are so many gigantic things on the horizon that need to be answered that one would think, I mean, you think of Kennedy and Nixon, they talked about the issues pretty thoroughly. Even Carter and Ford in 76 did. But this has become one outrageous thing after another. And I don't think the voters are any more educated than they were before the first debate started.
Questioning policies, questioning plans. I mean, we've asked about that for such a long time and not gotten much coming back. That might say that we're not going to get much coming back as we go forward either. Just finally from you, though, because this is the last time we're going to have a chance to talk, with the media and how all of this has been covered, do you feel they've done a good job in general? I mean, they've been thwarted by some of the same issues, too, as voters would be. But has media done a good job in being able to position this so that people can understand what's happening?
I think it's fashionable for members of the media to criticize the media. But I will answer the question saying, no, I don't know if they've done a good job. I think Donald Trump's rise to power, rise to the nomination, was always facilitated by a media members of the media who saw him as a personality, as a celebrity, and said, wow, this is pretty amazing stuff. It only seems now, and now the coverage is really overwhelmingly critical, which is unusual for the media, but I see many reporters and journalists and columnists writing things that just are truth-squatting Donald Trump. You know, if he says good morning to somebody, they'll truth-squat that. I think they are overcompensating for what they failed to do in the beginning, and that was let Donald Trump have this free ride for so long.
Ken, I've enjoyed being able to talk with you over these last couple of weeks. We'll look forward to more times in the future.
It was my pleasure, and say hello to that Neil Conan guy.
And we promise to do just that. Ken Rudin is one of America's foremost experts in politics and campaign history. He focuses on presidential elections, the races for the House and Senate and state governors. He's joined us while Neil Conan has been traveling. Neil is back in his regular spot next Tuesday, and he'll join us this week for the Pledge Drive. Now, late last week, we had a problem recording the show. Lucky for us, News Exposure had captured the hour and donated the recording to HPR. We'd like to thank Craig Travitz, the client relations manager at Dateline and News Exposure, for helping us out. We appreciate it. That's pretty much going to do it for us for this hour of The Conversation. We promise we'll be back tomorrow, won't we?
We certainly will.
We'll have Neil Milner and the Longview.
And the Hot Club of Hooloville will don its Paniolo duds and perform in our studio.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
And now we're going to go over to Pledge Central to see how we're doing with Ray Cruz.